You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel on Sunday, the 21st of April. In the headlines, 27-year-old Reserve Major Dora Zimmel, injured last week on the northern border, has died of his wounds. Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will hit Hamas shortly. The War Cabinet convenes to discuss the deadlock in the hostage release talks and future operations in Gaza. The Israel security agency Shin Bet denies a Daily Mail report that only 40 hostages remain alive. The IDF concludes its operation in Tul Karem in the West Bank after killing 14 gunmen. Last, Israeli anger over the possibility of the US imposing sanctions on the IDF's Netzach Yehuda battalion. Last-minute preparations ahead of Pesach, the festival of Passover, which begins tomorrow night. And the weather, a Sharav heatwave later this week. Good evening, this is Mark Weiss with the news. A reservist officer critically wounded in the Hezbollah drone and missile attack on the northern border community of Arab al-Aramsha last week has succumbed to his wounds. Reserve Major Dor Zimmel, aged 27, was a deputy company commander in the Etzioni Brigade from Evan Yehuda. Another 13 soldiers and 4 civilians were wounded in the attack on April the 17th, during which Hezbollah launched 2 anti-tank missiles and an explosive-laden drone from Lebanon, targeting a community centre where soldiers were gathered. Prime Minister Netanyahu said Sunday in a Pesach message that Israel will land additional hits on Hamas in moves that will take place soon, while addressing the stalled prisoner release deal with the terror group. We'll increase military and political pressure on Hamas in the coming days, seeing as it's the only way to release our hostages and gain victory, he said. The War Cabinet is meeting at this hour for the first time in 12 days to discuss the current impasse in the hostage talks with Hamas and pursuing the military campaign in the Gaza Strip. The British Daily Mail reported today, based on what it said was intelligence from the Israel security agency Shin Bet, that only 40 out of the 133 hostages held in Gaza are still alive. However, the Shin Bet denied the report, calling it incorrect, and saying that it does not reflect the views of the Shin Bet. Hamas leader abroad, Ismail Haniyeh, says Israel is interested only in getting back the hostages and afterwards resuming the war, and this will not happen. Haniyeh met yesterday in Istanbul with Turkish President Erdogan, who urged the Palestinians to unite for victory against Israel. Yaron Blum, a former senior Israel Security Agency Shin Bet official who served as coordinator of captives and the missing, says Israel must change its approach to break the impasse in the hostage release talks, to do something that will shake them up again, he said. As soon as we see achievements, such as the assassination of Hamas military leadership, you will very soon see a return to the negotiations, he said in an interview with Kan. Thousands of people demonstrated in Tel Aviv last night, demanding a hostage release deal. Protesters who had gathered earlier on Kaplan Street for a demonstration demanding early elections joined the rally for the hostages at the Begin Gate of the Kiryat Defence Compound. The Hostages and Missing Families Forum, which represents many of the hostage families, is calling on members of the War Cabinet to meet urgently with them before the Passover holiday for an update on what is being done to return their loved ones. 133 hostages are being held in Gaza, not all of them alive, for 198 days. Defence Minister Yoav Gallant said Israel is preventing Hezbollah and Iranian forces from entrenching along the Syrian border with Israel. Speaking during a visit to IDF units on the Syrian border, he said, "We are preserving our freedom to operate against any position or enemy who poses a risk to us." War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz reassured residents of the north that Israel is approaching the moment of truth in terms of how to proceed militarily against Hezbollah. In a speech this afternoon, he said, "This is the operative front with the greatest and most urgent challenge, and this is how we must treat it." He went on, "I appeal from here to the evacuees, who will also celebrate Seder night outside their homes, and I promise we see you. We recognise the enormous difficulty and your great courage. We will work to bring you home safely, even before the start of the school year." In the north today, Hezbollah claimed responsibility for firing an anti-tank rocket towards Dovev this morning, causing damage but no injuries. Sirens sounded a number of times on the northern border, including the Western Galilee this morning. Several landing sites were identified in open areas. Lebanese media reported Israeli airstrikes in South Lebanon. The IDF overnight struck 3 Hezbollah sites in South Lebanon. Separately, the Russian news agency Sputnik reported that Israeli fighter jets overnight targeted a Syrian air defense base in Dara, causing damage. There was no independent confirmation. The IDF says it has ended a 50-hour-long operation in the West Bank's Nur Shams refugee camp adjacent to Tulkarm. During the raid, troops killed 14 terrorists in clashes, detained 15 wanted Palestinians, discovered and destroyed dozens of explosives and captured weapons, according to the military. 9 soldiers and 1 border police officer were hurt during the clashes. They were listed in light and moderate condition. Palestinian media initially reported that the commander of the local Palestinian Islamic Jihad wing in Tulkarm was killed during the raid. But Israel believes he did not actually die, and he was purportedly seen in footage at the funerals of other gunmen. In a decoy terror attack in the Binyamin region of the West Bank this morning, an Israeli was lightly injured when an explosive device detonated as he tried to remove a Palestinian flag that had been planted on a pole alongside the road, close to the settlement of Kochav HaShachar, northeast of Ramallah. The Israeli man had pulled over his car and walked over to the flag, and the explosive went off when he kicked over the pole. In a separate terror incident near the Bet Anun junction near Hebron, IDF forces shot and killed 2 terrorists, one of whom tried to stab them and another who opened fire. There were no Israeli casualties. Elsewhere, shots were fired at the Salem post near north of Jenin and at Kibbutz Merav in the Gilboa region. There were no casualties, but damage was caused to a home inside the kibbutz. Israeli leaders from across the political spectrum have decried reports that the United States plans to impose sanctions on the ultra-Orthodox Netzach Yehuda battalion over alleged human rights abuses in the West Bank. The Axios website reported that the sanctions would ban the battalion and its members from receiving any kind of US military assistance or training. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the reported move absurd and a moral low. War Cabinet member and National Unity Party leader Benny Gantz called it a dangerous precedent. Opposition leader Yair Lapid called the planned sanctions a mistake and said the source of the problem is not the military level, but the political level. The IDF spokesperson issued a statement that the Netzach Yehuda battalion is currently engaged in the war in Gaza, acting with courage and professionalism while upholding the values and spirit of the IDF and the principles of international law. Throughout the past year, the fighters have been at the heart of the operational activities around the clock in order to protect the security of Israeli citizens, alongside being a battalion that leads the integration of Haredi Orthodox combat soldiers into the IDF. Following reports of sanctions against the battalion, the IDF said it is unaware of such a development. If a decision is made on the matter, it will be assessed. The IDF acts and will continue to act to ensure that any unusual event is investigated in a thorough manner and in accordance with the law. The reports about the possible American action against Netzach Yehuda came after the US and the European Union imposed sanctions on Bentzi Gopstein, an ally of National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and two entities that raised money for Israelis accused of settler violence. The latest actions aimed against people who escalate violence in the West Bank. Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Maurice Hirsch is the director of the Initiative for Palestinian Authority Accountability and Reform in the Jerusalem Centre for Public Affairs and the former director of the Military Prosecution for Judea and Samaria. We spoke with him about the latest batch of sanctions and the reports that Washington will also sanction the IDF's Netzer Yehuda Battalion.
So basically, the sanctions that were imposed by both the Americans and the Europeans is to list a number of persons / organizations as terrorists, as basically terrorist entities. That then subjects them to all types of sanctions that are applied to those categories of institutions and people that prevent them from banking processes and travel, obviously, and really do give that whole connecting envelope of a terrorist entity that should be sanctioned and then dealt with on a more fundamental basis.
Now, we know one of the people in the latest batch of sanctions was Bensi Gopstein. He's the head of the Lahava organization, which was decreed to be racist earlier this year by the courts. What about the other individuals and the two small right-wing groups that were chosen for the sanctions? What do we know about these groups and these people?
So I think the organizations that were targeted by the sanctions are predominantly unknown for the most part. They are people who are, in some cases, have some type of a public figure, but nothing more than that. In some cases, we're talking about the European sanctions, about almost journalists, people who carry out journalistic functions, Meir Ettinger, Elisha Yared, these people who are also sometimes involved in activities which the EU may consider to be violent, but they, under that whole environment of exposing what is actually going on, obviously these are people who are on, and it's really important to stress, these are people who are on basically the fringe of Israeli society. In many cases, they are people who are not in any way part of the mainstream. They are have their own groups and circles of friends, and really it's something which most Israeli society doesn't even see as an integral part of what's going on.
The US and European spokespeople in the past have claimed that these individuals and organizations were directly linked to in most cases, violent actions against Palestinians in the West Bank. Is that true?
So the question of the involvement of these people who have been sanctioned both previously and currently in acts of violence is questionable. In some cases, you have people who have been involved in some type of violence but have never been convicted of crimes. Here, basically, what the Europeans and the U.S. administration have relied on are reports and accusations against these people without really ever giving a clear indication of why they are specifically targeting them. Even in cases where you have convictions for certain offenses, that isn't necessarily a basis for imposing the whole sanctions regime. And really, what these sanctions show, both the previous ones and the current ones show, is a heavy, heavy bias against Israel and against Israelis. For example, the Palestinian Authority has an entire program to incentivize the murderers of Jews. Everybody knows about it. The world knows about it. The European knows about it. The U.S. administration knows about it. And yet no one on that program, starting with Mahmoud Abbas and downwards, has ever been the subject of any sanctions. Now, one is the case of private individuals who may or may not be involved in illegal activity. and the other is a institutional policy of incentivizing and rewarding murder. And the U.S. administration seems to have completely ignored those people, choosing only to focus on specific individuals in Israeli society who they seek to demonize as part of a wider plan.
These, I believe, are the third round of sanctions imposed by the U.S. and the Europeans on far-right individuals. But there was something new emerging also over the weekend. There was a report on the Axios website, which is usually quite reliable, that the administration is now considering sanctions against the Netzach Yehuda battalion of the IDF. Can you explain to our listeners what this battalion is and why would the U.S. sanctions battalions against an IDF unit?
So this is probably the most outrageous report that we've seen. And if it proves to be true, is something which would really be a major step forward in U.S. policy against Israel. Netzach Yehuda is one of the fighting battalions in the IDF. It's an integral part of the IDF. It's a unit which is predominantly made up of ultra-Orthodox soldiers who have come into the army, and really it's been the source of not a small amount of focus by the anti-Israel groups, because here you're talking about not only Jews living in Israel, but religious Jews living in Israel who they seek to demonize on a constant basis. And really what this decision, if it really folds out to be true, it means is that the U.S. administration is saying that the IDF has an organization, has a unit, which has a policy of breaching human rights, and that the IDF is not doing anything about that in order to enforce the law against soldiers who act in a manner which is not in any way, shape, or form part of IDF policy. That has far-reaching consequences, specifically for the International Court of Criminal Court, where Israel claims to have a legal system which effectively enforces the law. And what these U.S. sanctions are really saying is that the U.S. administration doesn't trust Israel's internal law enforcement against soldiers who breach the law. That is something which is a statement against the entire IDF and the entire law enforcement in the IDF. And if it happens, will truly be something very, very disastrous. And really, it would be equivalent to the U.S. administration handing the IDF to the International Criminal Court on a silver platter.
A few of the soldiers in this battalion were convicted of violence against some Palestinian detainees a few months ago, and they were disciplined, I believe.
Yes, indeed. There have indeed been instances in a few army units, in a few IDF units. Unfortunately, the IDF, whilst the circumstances are possibly less, the IDF in some cases is not different from other armies, and as you have misconduct by soldiers in every other army, so you have that occasionally also in the IDF. Those instances are dealt with forcibly by the IDF, whether it be in command chained procedures or even with criminal prosecutions. And that is something which is seen has been assumed to be very effective until now, which is why you don't see very, very wide-scale cases of abuses.
How on earth would this, assuming these sanctions are introduced against this battalion, how on earth would it work in practice? Suppose there's an airlift coming in of 100 APCs and a few thousand rockets. The IDF would have to ensure that equipment doesn't reach this battalion?
Yes, that's what it would require. It would require the IDF to differentiate with all of the equipment that it receives from the U.S. between one of its units and all of the rest, and thereby vilifying them entirely. That means really closing the unit effectively, because obviously a unit like that couldn't continue to function, being completely separate from the rest of the IDF.
Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Maurice Hirsch, the director of the Initiative for Palestinian Authority Accountability and Reform in the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, and the former director of military prosecution for Judea and Samaria. Tuesday will mark 200 days since the beginning of the Gaza War. Jerusalem resident Rachel Goldberg-Pauline is the mother of 23-year-old Hirsch, who was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival and was taken into captivity after losing his arm when terrorists tossed a grenade into a bomb shelter by a bus stop near the festival site, where Hirsch and others were sheltering. Time magazine recently named Rachel Goldberg-Pauline as one of its People of the Year. She spoke today in a Zoom conversation organized by the Jerusalem Press Club.
Time is very much something that doesn't make sense to us. But I never considered anything. I mean, we're all in this slow motion, ambiguous trauma that continues to unfold. And so we're not in the same dimension of experience as people who are sort of in a normal range of life.
Right. It's essentially a parallel universe happening together. How will you and your family be marking Passover, if at all?
So we are, we're going to be going to dear friends who are like family, and we're also going to be with some of our families, some close cousins who are very, they're all very sensitive, thoughtful, kind, also going through this with us. They're all very close to Hirsch. And so we are going to be doing a Seder in a way that the truth is, Rabbi Nachman from Breslov says that the Seder is really a time to be shouting out to God, that it's really a prayer service. It's not a meal. It sort of evolved into that over time, but really this is a prayer service. We start with, telling the beginning of the story of the Jewish people at their lowest point. And by the end of the Seder, we're begging and screaming out for an end to the suffering and for Eliyahu Hanavi, for Elijah the prophet, to enter and to escort in the idea of the Messiah, the idea of a time when there will be no more suffering and no more war. And so all of the symbolic things that we do at the Seder will take on a much more profound and deep meaning this year: the bread of affliction, the bitter herbs, the salt water that represents the tears of the Jewish people when they were in captivity, in slavery. So we'll be doing that with these, this close group of friends, and they have been very clear that if 15 minutes in, if an hour in, we just can't do it, or if we're all needing to cry, we will all cry. So I think it will be a Seder and an existential form of therapy in certain ways.
You know, in our story of Passover, we had Moses, we had this one individual who was responsible for asking Pharaoh to let our people go. Do you think that such character exists these days and, in the reality that we're living? Is Moses a collection of people? And what expectations do you have for this character if he did exist?
Wow, it's a really insightful question. I don't know if maybe Moses is a composite of a few different people that have influence on the few people that have power to make decisions in this particular case. I do think that something that we need all of our leaders to be doing, all of them, is to make the decision to care about and love their own people more than they hate their enemies, and to let their own people go. Rather than asking someone else to let specific people go, I think we all have to decide to let our own people go. And that requires people to make a conscious, difficult, brave decision to care about their own people more than they hate their enemies.
Have you heard anything in the last few days about, you know, developments towards a hostage deal? Are you concerned about any developments that we've heard? I think even this morning we heard that that the Qataris are skeptical that Hamas will continue to control Gaza, and this really is our, you know, our only negotiating partner right now.
The truth is that one of the things that I've learned in this crash course of geopolitics and military strategy and media acumen is that never to really take the news at face value. I wouldn't even say to take it with a grain of salt. I would say to take it with a pail of salt. There have been so many examples of when something is shared in the media and then it's absolutely not accurate that I very rarely read anything. I definitely don't watch the news. So I am not, you know, the best person to ask about latest developments. And I would just remain optimistic and hopeful and doing all the work that we do, trying to talk to every single person that we can talk to, who's a person in power or with influence, or even people who are not in power and who have influence, because we don't know who is going to be the vessel, who is going to be the vehicle, where is the key that's going to unlock this quagmire of misery and angst and trauma that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are experiencing right now because of this.
I understand. We did have one question that came in with regards to everything that's happened vis-a-vis Iran over the last couple of weeks. And if you or your, you know, the other people who you're helping have felt in any way, not necessarily sidelined, but has the issue, has your personal issue been, you know, has lost attention in the wake of this this war with Iran over the last couple of weeks? You know, every couple of days we hear something new about Israel's response, Iran's response, and if this has influenced in any way the conversations that you're having in trying to push forward and ensure that the issue of the hostages remains on the both the national agenda, but also on the international agenda.
I think certainly without a doubt, the Iranian attack between Saturday night and Sunday morning here made a humongous impact in terms of where the focus was, and now continues sort of this trajectory to worry about the larger picture in the region. I think that makes sense. Obviously, as the mother of a hostage, I'm not happy about it, but I understand that, you know, so many different countries and world leaders are focused on how can we de-escalate the situation in this entire region so that we don't lead to World War III. I understand that, you know, naturally people are not going to be having necessarily you know, the 133 hostages as the top story. I will just say one thing about, you know, in the introduction, when you were talking about the 133, I think it's incredibly important and very often inaccurately reported that these 133 are Israelis. These 133 are from 25 different nations. There are Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, and Muslims who are being held. And I think that it is really critical that in reporting about this situation, that it is reported accurately, because otherwise this does become a very specific, monolithic, homogenous group of people, which it's not. And so I do, while I understand that, you know, certainly while the attack was going on and for the few days afterwards with the decision of Israel to retaliate, how to retaliate, what are we going to do? What are they going to do? But I think that now that ship has sailed. I think for the moment, you know, everybody's gotten their last licks in. And now we can pivot to these people. And I would say that there are so many stressful heated issues that are being discussed now in this entire region. And there is one panacea that would deflate and release the pressure in all areas, and that is to let these 133 people, these cherished souls, be released after almost 200 days in captivity. And, you know, we understand that there is a deal that was on the table that for the first time, not just the U.S. and Israel, but Qatar and Egypt were giving their blessing to and saying, this is a solid deal for Hamas. And it was going to be a very painful and very steep price for Israel. But Israel leaned in. And so now when we have voices all over the world saying, stop the suffering in Gaza, we agree with that. We, meaning, you know, my family and certainly the hostage families, we want all the suffering in Gaza to stop, including the suffering of the 133 people who we all know intimately. And this is an opportunity for other parties to say, we're going to actually stop the suffering of the Gazan innocent people who are really bearing the brunt of this, along with other innocent people who are currently living in Gaza, of which I know one of them very, very dearly and well.
Rachel Goldberg-Pullin, the mother of 23-year-old Hirsch, who was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival. These are the stories making headlines at this hour. 27-year-old Reserve Major Dor Zimmel, injured last week on the northern border, has died of his wounds. Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will hit Hamas shortly. The War Cabinet convenes to discuss the deadlock in the hostage release talks and future operations in Gaza. The Israel Security Agency denies a Daily Mail report that only 40 hostages remain alive. The IDF concludes its operation in Tulkarm in the West Bank after killing 14 gunmen. Israeli anger over the possibility of the US imposing sanctions on the IDF's Netzach Yehuda battalion. Last-minute preparations ahead of Pesach, the festival of Passover, which begins on Monday evening, and the weather, a Sharav heatwave later this week. According to foreign media reports, in an alleged Israeli strike in Iran, between Thursday and Friday night, Israeli F-35 fighter jets fired high-tech missiles from a vast distance at an S-300 air defence battery in Isfahan, capable of evading Iran's air defences. Khan reported last night the decision to empty the weaponry was intended to demonstrate the capabilities of destroying a complex target in the heart of Iran without claiming responsibility or escalating the direct confrontation with Iran. In Iraq, one member of a Shiite militia group was killed and 8 wounded in a weekend attack on a base belonging to the Popular Mobilization Forces, a coalition of Iran-allied militias. Washington denied carrying out the attack. Iraqi authorities said on Saturday that they are investigating the explosion that took place at the Kalsu military base north of Babylon, a former US base that was handed over to the Iraqi military in 2011. Here is Max Romeo and the Upsetters with War in a Babylon.
Tribal war in a Babylon.
Romeo and the Upsetters, War in a Babylon. An independent panel conducting a review into severe allegations of terror involvement of UN Palestinian Refugee Agency staff members is set to release its final report on Monday. The review process was set up earlier this year after at least 15 countries froze their funding for UNRWA, following accusations by Israel that at least 12 organisation employees were directly involved in the October the 7th atrocities perpetrated by Hamas. Another 30 assisted or facilitated those crimes, and as much as 12% of the organisation's staff were affiliated with terror groups. These accusations came against the background of numerous past reports of anti-Semitism and glorification of terrorism amongst UNRWA staff, particularly within the agency's extensive education system. In March, the review panel, headed by former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, said in an interim report that UNRWA has in place a significant number of mechanisms and procedures to ensure compliance, although it conceded that there are critical areas that still need to be addressed. Ahead of the release of the review, the monitoring group UN Watch released its own report, claiming that the review group is neither neutral nor independent. UN Watch Executive Director Hillel Noyer told the Jerusalem Press Club that far from being independent, the review group was rigged from the outset.
We don't know formally. There was no sunlight put on the process. But we do know that although it was the Secretary General who on February 5th made the announcement, as he said, in consultation with UNRWA Commissioner General, in fact, it was the UNRWA chief himself, Philippe Lazzarini, who had announced a few weeks prior that he was setting up this review. So in news articles that appeared in Associated Press and a video in Associated Press and an interview with Australia's ABC Radio on January 17th, 18th, and 19th, a series of news reports and interviews, Lazzarini had announced about 3 weeks prior that he was setting up the review. He said, I will commission a review into these various issues, and I will try to appoint a third party that is reputable, either a professional consulting group, he said, or some independent entity. So clearly it was the Commissioner General of UNRWA himself who initiated the review and who formed it. So it seems that all the Secretary General did here was announce it and make it in his name. But it seems very clear from what UNRWA itself said that they were the ones who made the selections of the members, because they said they were going to choose the members. And so it seems that they crafted the whole thing themselves.
Okay, so I understand that UN Watch says, you know, argues that after your revelation, the committee they established to investigate this is flawed and tainted to begin with. Why the rush now? I mean, after, regardless of what was the impetus, countries stopped funding. So now UNRWA is kind of defunded. I think there's a few countries that are still funding it, but the general tone is that UNRWA itself is tainted, and European countries, the West, are not funding it. Why the rush to publish this report about the International Review Group?
So the question, why did they create this review group? So initially, as I indicated, there was the pressure of our report. I should also mention, very important, January 15th, 2 days before Lazzarini made the announcement, he received a letter from the U.S. Congress, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and others, demanding that Lazzarini appear before the Congress and answer questions about his staff ties with terrorism. And he chose not to appear. And it seems that the review group was meant to be sort of to show that they're doing something. So it seems that the purpose of the review group is to show various stakeholders that UNRWA is doing something about the allegations. But at the same time, we know that it's designed for countries to climb down from the suspension and to reinstate funding. And indeed, we have the quotes themselves. Chris Gunness, who was spokesman for 12 years and left a few years ago, but just came back to UNRWA in a surrogate capacity, in an unofficial capacity. He's been aggressive as a spokesman for UNRWA on social media, on Twitter, as well as on Al Jazeera and other platforms. He said that, and I'm going to give you the exact quote, it's in our report. He told Pass Blue, which is a website that advocates for the UN, he said, quote, I hope the external report by former French minister, soon to be available, will provide the donors with further cover, I'm quoting, provide the donors with further cover, if that's what they need, within their own internal constituencies to resume funding for UNRWA. So Chris Gunness, who there's no one more plugged into what UNRWA is thinking and doing, he said expressly that the whole point is to give donors cover for their internal constituencies who are going to say, what are you doing? The whole report is to provide cover. So in other words, the report is not an impartial investigation into how anywhere from 500 to 2,000 UNRWA officials belong to Hamas or Islamic Jihad in Gaza, not into the fact that our group, for example, has been sending for 10 years warnings to UNRWA that they have thousands of staff, we estimated thousands, who incite terrorism, and their response by Chris Gunness was to attack us. Not that UNRWA is going to impartially investigate why 3,000 teachers were part of a chat group that celebrated the atrocities. So none of those things, but rather it's to provide cover for donors to resume funding for UNRWA to satisfy their, quote, internal constituencies. So he said it himself. And indeed, I quoted before Lazzarini, who said, even as he announced on January 17th, and 2 days afterwards in various interviews given, even as he announced to AP and Australia's ABC Radio that he's going to commission an independent review into allegations about neutrality breaches, that's a euphemism at the UN, as he said, allegations that they have ties with Hamas. Let's not use the euphemism. Even then, he said that these allegations constitute, they're disingenuous, they're politically motivated, and they are a smear campaign. So right from the beginning, we know that UNRWA, which created the review, never treated this as a serious investigation into widespread promotion of terrorism, complicity with terrorism. The head of the union for years in Gaza was Su'eil al-Hindi, the head of the UNRWA staff union. He's a member of the Hamas Politburo with Yahya Sinwar. He was elected publicly in 2017. To the Hamas Politburo, he's one of the leaders of Hamas. And eventually he was embarrassed UNRWA was embarrassed by the public revelations, so they let him go. They actually asked him to resign so he can still collect his UNRWA pension today. And when he was suspended the first time in 2011, 8,000 UNRWA teachers in Gaza went on strike at Hamas's initiative to rally in his support. They went on strike for 3 months. The UNRWA teachers shut down 243 schools, abandoned 220,000 students, and there were 8,000 teachers rallying for the Hamas Politburo member, Su'eil al-Hindi, to remain the Gaza staff union leader. So to say that it's just a few bad apples, which has been the talking point of UNRWA's apologists, is absurd. 8,000 UNRWA teachers went on strike for 3 months to support the Hamas Politburo member for his right to be the UNRWA staff union, even though he works for Hamas. So all of this is treated as a smear campaign, which is very sad. UNRWA is not taking it seriously. So that is the origin of this review, and that's why we think it's very important to ask the question, who are the members of the review group, and what do we expect to see?
Hillel Noya, Executive Director of the NGO UN Watch. The Passover holiday begins at sundown tomorrow evening. Rabbi Shimshon Nadel, rabbi of Kehilat Zikron Yosef in Har Nof, Jerusalem, shares thoughts on the holiday against the backdrop of the ongoing war.
At the Seder table each year, we ask, why is this night different from all other nights? I think this year, the question on all of our minds is, why is this Pesach, or how is this Pesach different from all other Pesachs? Because this year, Pesach is very different. Instead of koshering the kitchen for Pesach, we spent last Saturday night biting our nails and waiting, bracing ourselves for an impending attack from Iran. We woke to the sound of sirens and explosions at around 2 a.m., safely making our way with our children and our neighbors down into the bomb shelter. And after a number of minutes, which felt like an eternity, we finally returned to our beds and tried to get some sleep. We tried, as any little noise from a passing car or truck startled us. Awake for most of the night, one could not help but be reminded of the verse which describes how in Egypt, as the Jewish people prepared to leave, they were commanded, "You shall not leave the entrance of the house until morning." Hearing the sound of fighter jets overhead evoked echoes of the verse, "Hashem will pass over the entrance, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your homes to smite you." God was protecting his people as the IDF, together with our allies, intercepted hundreds of Iranian drones and missiles. It was nothing short of miraculous, a night of miracles in the modern-day miracle that is Medinat Yisrael, a night of protection. Seder night is called by the Torah a Leil Shimurim, a night of protection. It is a night of protection for Hashem to take them out of the land of Egypt. That was the night for Hashem, a protection for all the children of Israel for their generations. The verse describes it as a night of protection both for God and for the children of Israel. And as Rashi explains, God was protecting the promise he made to Abraham to redeem his descendants, the Jewish people, from Egypt. And we, the Jewish people, too, are protected on that night. As Rashi writes, it is a night that is guarded from that time onward against harmful spirits, as it says, he will not permit the destroyer. According to our sages, Seder night is a night on which God provides the Jewish people with additional spiritual protection. A night when we are unconcerned with harm. A night when we feel safe. This sense of safety and security finds expression in a number of Jewish laws and customs. We drink the four cups unconcerned about being harmed by negative spiritual forces that can prey upon us when things are done in pairs, according to the Talmud. We open the door to our homes during the Seder and invoke that it is a night of protection, and we need not fear. Some record the custom to leave the doors unlocked, along with other customs which express our confidence. But this year, in light of the war, many of us feel anything but safe. Feelings of uncertainty abound. We feel vulnerable, fragile, especially with hostages still missing, their fate unknown, especially in light of so much loss. So many of our best and brightest who have fallen in battle, making the ultimate sacrifice for the Jewish people and the Jewish state. So many empty seats at the Seder table this year. But the Midrash suggests that this night of protection is not limited to Pesach Mitzrayim, that first Pesach in Egypt, or even the Seder night as we experience it today, but it alludes to the future redemption of Israel. As the Torah describes, it is a night of protection for generations, for future generations. And according to tradition, it is a night which historically saw a number of redemptions, a number of miracles, and a night which will herald in the final redemption. The Midrash relates, it is a night during which he performs great deeds for the righteous, just as he performed for Israel and Egypt. On that night, he rescued Chizkiyahu, and on it he rescued Hananiah and his fellows, and on it he rescued Daniel from the lion's den, and on it the Mashiach, the Messiah, and Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, will be exalted. We are living through difficult times, challenging times, and confusing times. But we are also fortunate to be living during miraculous times. On Pesach, we praise and thank Hashem for redeeming us from the slavery of Egypt, and long and pray for that final redemption. May it come speedily in our days. Amen. In the meantime, we recognize the miracles and protection that Hashem provides every day here for us in the state of Israel. Wishing all of the listeners a Pesach Kasher v'sameach, a happy and healthy Pesach. May it be a time of redemption for us as a nation and as individuals.
Rabbi Shimshon Nadel. Now, Chava Alberstein with Chad Gadya.
שנשך לחתול שטרף את הגדי שאבינו ושחט את השור ששתה את המים שקיבו את האש ששרפה את המקל שחפת בכלב שנשך לחתול שטרף את הגדי שאבינו הביא ובמלאך המוות והרג את השוחט ששחט את השור ששתה את המים שקיבו את האש ששרפה את המקל שחפת בכלב שנשך לחתול שטרף את הגדי שאבינו הביא Zabina ba betrezus od gadia khad gadia Na pitomat shara khad gadia aviv od lo igia u fesakh lo ba U ma ishtana loch ma ishtana ani ishtaneti li hashava די שלב היום אני נמר וזאב טורף הייתי כבר יונה והייתי צבי היום איני יודעת מי אני וזבינה במצריזוס עד גדיה אחד גדיה כנבי נוגדי בשני סוסים שוב מתחילים להתחלה
The weather outlook hotter tomorrow, particularly inland. Hotter tomorrow, particularly inland and on the hills. Windy along the coast from the afternoon. Tuesday, hot to Sharav heatwave. Windy along the coast from the afternoon. Wednesday, a Sharav heatwave. Temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow. Jerusalem, 13 to 25. Tel Aviv, 18 to 25. Haifa, 17 to 21. Tzfat, 13 to 21. Tiberias, 17 to 29. Beersheva, 15 to 29. And Inilat from 20 tonight. Rising to 33 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Another look at the main headlines at this hour. 27-year-old Reserve Major Dor Zimmel, injured last week on the northern border, has died of his wounds. Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will hit Hamas shortly. The War Cabinet convenes to discuss the deadlock in the hostage release talks and future actions in Gaza. The Israel security agency Shin Bet denies a Daily Mail report that only 40 hostages remain alive. The IDF concludes its operation in Tul Karum in the West Bank after killing 14 gunmen. Israeli anger over the possibility of the US imposing sanctions on the IDF's Netzach Yehuda battalion. And last-minute preparations ahead of Pesach, the festival of Passover, which begins tomorrow evening. And the weather, a Sharav heatwave later this week. This is Mark Weiss, wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.